We're talking about a dynamic new era for women in Congress and acknowledging the trailblazers who helped pave the way. A shout out to Shirley Chisholm here. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Representative Katie Porter of California is starting her second term in Congress. Single mom, three kids. She said Congress wasn't built for members like her. She told Vanity Fair this week that she welcomes more single parents to Congress, but it's important to think about not just being here, but being effective here. Are you a woman who's considered running for elected office or ran and won? What's it been like? What compelled you to seek office? And who supported you through thick and thin? 800-642-1234. Jennifer Steinhauer is a veteran political reporter for The New York Times. Her new book is called The Firsts, The Inside Story of the Women Reshaping Congress. Jennifer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. So women in Congress, it's really a mixed bag. We're elated that it's more diverse because of women elected, but it's still only less than a quarter of women Congresses, not reflective at all of our nation's makeup whatsoever. What is your assessment there? Is this really progress?
You know, it's interesting because when I was writing my book, I interviewed Pat Schroeder, who was a trailblazing member of Congress in the 70s. And her view was that it wasn't, that if you're only 25% of the legislative body, and that's obviously not reflecting the overall population, you can't call it progress. I think, though, that we are at a bit of a turning point where you're going to start to see numbers go up steadily and steadily and steadily, in part because Republican women have made some gains. You have to have women in both parties win elections to ever have anything close to half of Congress. And I just think that the momentum really kind of feels there now for women.
The momentum feels there now, but let's look at some of those trailblazers who paved the way. Shirley Chisholm, first Black woman elected to Congress, and she said she met more opposition being a woman than being Black. How do you read that? Why did men hold her back as a woman?
Yeah, that's really interesting because at that time, remember, she's running in the 70s in Brooklyn. Her opponent in the primary there made a big deal of her being a woman and basically said, you know, more or less, we can't have a woman doing this job. I don't think you would see that kind of overt sexist commentary, particularly in a Democratic primary, but in any election. But that was where she was coming from. And she always felt that she was facing more sexism within her own party, as well as in the opposition party, than she did racism, although that was certainly something that she tackled repeatedly. If you look back at her speeches, they feel very tailored to this moment in so many ways. In fact, I do recommend, if anyone's interested in Shirley Chisholm, who's kind of had sort of a revival in recent years, she was a little bit forgotten after mm-hmm. leaving Congress. Now there's kind of all kinds of, in New York especially, you know, things dedicated to her, statues erected in her name. If you go back and read her speeches, it's remarkable how much they track with the Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement both right now.
In the women that you followed, how did they think of Chisholm? How did they view her? What inspiration did they get from her?
That's super interesting, too, because although there were many women in the 70s, some of them whom I had actually not heard of until I started to research the book, but many that I had, of course, she seems to be the one who's had this stick-to-itiveness. And she's the one who younger millennial members knew by name, knew her history, knew her record, coveted her office, have, you know, paintings of her, pictures of her. I would notice sometimes it was the first piece of artwork that would go up in their office. So she really did seem to symbolize a lot to many of them.
We're talking with Jennifer Steinhauer, a veteran political reporter at The New York Times, and her new book is The Firsts. You can join in. What do you think about the record number of women elected to seats in the House and Senate? Are you a woman who's considering running for elected office? What has spurred you on? Who or what has held you back? 800-642-1234 to join in. I was really struck about these little snippets of life inside the Capitol. And you talked about Representative Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington taking her 5-week-old onto the floor as she was trying to get a vote in. And there she is trying to soothe her newborn and do her job at the same time. How do women with kids do this?
I have to say that was a very striking moment for me, which is why it ended up in the book for a couple of reasons. Because when I started covering Congress in 2010, it was really that I don't think you would have seen that scene. And it's not because there are so many more women now. As we pointed out, there are a record number of women, but it's not like any kind of huge number in a majority, even half, we just discussed. But I think it had more to do with the way women have become more open and talking about the fact that they're trying to integrate parenthood, motherhood. You mentioned Katie Porter talking about being a single mother and the challenges of that. I think that's just become more part of the, and with along with younger men being in Congress too, by the way, more part of the external dialogue of what it means to be in these kind of weird and difficult jobs. I know Jahana Hayes, who I talked to at one point, said she her staff knows that there's certain hours of the day where she just will not do meetings because she's FaceTiming with her kids doing homework and so forth. So I think that that scene was sort of very new in a way. You know, Tammy Duckworth in the Senate had to pave the way there to bring her baby on the floor. They had to like basically pass a rule for that. A lot of the men were really resistant to that. But it's just really kind of evolved just in the last few years, I think.
And now, you know, we're asking the question whether Butler in particular, who's a Republican, can survive her Trump impeachment vote. What is blowback like on a very controversial move there by her, especially as a woman?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And again, it gets into a point that I try to make to people, which is that at the long end of the day, you know, people always want to know and they always look to the research to know. Do women vote as a bloc? Do women work together as a bloc? Do you have a women's coalition, if you will, caucus in Congress? And at this point, what I would tell you is, unlike in the 70s, partisanship is everything. There's very few cases. They do exist, and it's almost more social than it is political or legislative or practical. But by and large, women vote with their party. So I think that her problems or Liz Cheney's problems or anybody who's in the Republican Party who turned against President Trump at the end has a problem within their party. But I don't think that's particularly a gendered issue.
One thing we learn when you're elected to office as a freshman, you literally have to learn how to navigate the halls of Congress. And they're really complicated. How difficult is it for freshmen to get their bearings?
I think it's pretty difficult, especially for those who have no Washington experience. You know, people come with various things. You know, they've been a lawmaker back in their home state, or they've been in jobs that have given them reason to come to Congress every now and then. But some of them have never been there, or they've only been there, you know, as a high school student on a tour. So it is this very gigantic city with all these office buildings. They literally have little subways that they can take if they choose to, from their house and Senate office buildings to the Capitol, where they go to vote and do their business, you know, that's not committee hearings and so forth. So it takes a while to understand all those little highways and byways. They all get there. They all get their little favorite routes. And we as reporters kind of memorize which members like to use their favorite routes to get here and there. But it definitely does take time, and it's not really part of their training.
Jennifer Steinhauer's new book, it's called The Firsts, and it chronicles the women who have been elected to Congress and are changing the power dynamic, reframing national debates on climate change, childcare, healthcare. What do you think about the record number of women elected to seats in the House and Senate? Do you think electing women lawmakers have consequences for voters? Are women more effective on policy, for instance, or listening to constituents back home? Join in your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jennifer Steinhauer here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing this new era of women in the halls of Congress. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A record number of women are serving in the 117th Congress, at least 118 women in the House, 24 women in the Senate. The New York Times' Jennifer Steinhauer has been writing about Congress for over a decade, and she traced the steps of 35 women who were newly elected in 2018 who helped make the 116th Congress the most diverse in our nation's history. And she asks this question, how will the women be remembered in 30 years? What is the meaning of this journey? And will we ever have a critical mass? Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Jennifer Steinhauer's new book is called The Firsts, and she is with us for the hour. Jennifer, to be elected, women have to first run and want to run. Is what is leading this? Is that more women are running, or more women are being asked to run?
It's both. Definitely, the number of women has increased in both parties a lot. In 2018 for Democrats and 2020 for Republican, record number of women ran, and it was historically the case that women had to be asked to run. And I will say that men very rarely look in the mirror and say, I'm not ready to run for something. They kind of see themselves as ready on day one, where women historically have thought of themselves as perhaps not being qualified, not having the credentials. And by the way, as women all know, this tracks quite closely with the private sector too, right? There's a lot of research that shows women often will look at a job description and view themselves as underqualified when they're not. And men don't usually to suffer that issue. And I always think about being on a panel once with Heidi Heitkamp, who was a senator from North Dakota, who said that women would come to her and say, I don't think I'm qualified to run for office. And she would say, hey, have you taken a look at the North Dakota legislature recently? And we would all laugh because, you know, it's full of all, you know, especially in state legislative bodies, it's full of all kinds of different people who have all different life experiences. So I think women are getting better at that. But again, just as in the private sector, that is a culturally still a very gendered difference. However, women are being asked more to run by their parties, by PACs, the leadership is looking more for women who are good fits for their district, I think, and being recruited more, and all the more important, as we all know, raising money for them.
When, before we go to the fundraising aspect, what about the trend there had been in the past of taking the deceased husband's seat? Are we over that? Is that still there?
That is basically a relic. So when you had Jeanette Rankin, who ran for the House the first time in 1917, before women even had the right to vote nationally, that was a real anomaly. She, in effect, was sort of a model for 100 years later, right? So running on her own accord, even though she had her family support for that, which was very important for women, they needed financial and the support systems of family members to run. But the vast majority of women in those early days, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, a Congress that might have two women, four women, back down to three women. Some are, you know, Republican-Democrat mix was pretty similar for the longest time. The vast majority of them did either have a family connection, and most likely they were filling the seats of their dead husbands. And they were not particularly controversial or surprising additions to Congress in those days, because they were viewed very much as extensions of their husbands. Oh, well, mm-hmm. That's Mark. That's Joan. We know her. She worked in the office. You know, she's just she worked with him. And at times they played quite critical roles in their campaigns or their offices. And so that's how they were viewed. They would request to be called Mrs. John Smith rather than by their own names.
Wow.
And that really changed in the 60s and 70s when women started to really run on their own accord. And that's interestingly when you start to see a lot more objections and abject sexism in the institution, out in the campaign. And by the way, in terms of being a mother, I will tell you that Bella Abzug, who was a very big figure from New York City in Congress, told Pat Shorter, you can't run with those kids. You can't do that. Mm. So it wasn't from men.
What did these congresswomen you talked to feel about Emily's List and these other organizations that are trying to get more women into office?
That's a really interesting question. You know, one of the reasons that Republican women have not been successful at recruiting and fostering and getting candidates to win is a lack of a cohesive financial structure like Emily's List, which for the longest time now has this record of really backing women, recruiting women, and just helping women get elected, especially through the all important fundraising aspect. Women have gotten to, Republican women sort of have started to lean into that more cohesive structure in 2020, and it was very helpful, and the party rallying around them in that way. But Emily's List makes it pretty clear that you need something institutional like that to help women. But what is interesting is I was told when I was reporting the book that some of the millennial women, I think in particular Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, were not interested in engaging with Emily's List because they are some ways viewed as sort of the kind of like, you know, white women's
old school.
Old school fundraising system. And I thought that was really interesting. And those are women who, and not just women, by the way, who are doing this, but have embraced a long time ago, you know, micro donations, raising money through social, you know, getting money from the people, if you will, in little smaller donations. So I think that's, it's Emily's List has evolved as a model for Republican women, but for some generation of Democratic women, it's actually become a bit of a relic.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jennifer Steinhauer, who's a veteran reporter for the New York Times, and her new book gives a fuller picture of the women who were elected to Congress in 2018. You can join in. Is there a particular congresswoman you admire now or in history? What has she done? What about her story do you connect with? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's look at fundraising. Asking for money is a big part of the job, especially in the House where there's always another election around the corner. How do these women view fundraising and making those calls to donors?
I think that they, you know, it's funny. With women and men, it's kind of always the same story. First of all, you're absolutely right. Literally the day you're sworn in, a lot of people have to run across the street to their party offices and start making fundraising calls again.
Because you can't make them in the Capitol.
You can't make them in the Capitol. You have to leave. That's the law. You have to leave the Capitol and go across the street to the party headquarters or you know, the library or someplace else to make those calls. That's the law. But it's definitely a big part of it. There was a man in Congress in that class who people said never came to committee hearings because all he was doing was running, trying to raise money for a very tough race that he was in. You know, the harder your race, the more money you need. And some people are just good at it. You mentioned Katie Porter again. There's a lot of people in the book besides Katie Porter, but she certainly was a breakout star and continues to be in the 117th Congress. She's just phenomenal at it. You know, some people are just good at asking other people for money and hitting the right donor base. And some people just can't stand it. And that does tend to be almost an individual quirk. But you're always under that pressure, always.
What makes her phenomenal? What does she do differently?
Well, you know, a big word that we hear a lot in politics, which probably gets overused, but I do think it was fundamental in very, very different kinds of ways for the women who won in 2018 and continues to be very important in all aspects of politics, is this concept of authenticity. And so she definitely had that. She was not hiding from being a single mom. It came out during her campaign that year in 2018 that she had suffered domestic violence abuse. She didn't bring that up, but when it came up, she did not run from that. She talked about that quite openly, her own experiences. And she was a law professor. She was actually a disciple of Elizabeth Warren, as many people know. And she has kind of that law professor way of doing things. When she goes on to committee hearings, she sort of sets things up as almost like a tutorial. And she brings her famous, now famous whiteboard and kind of can eviscerate witnesses who don't have the data and the knowledge at their fingertips to answer her questions. And that got a lot of attention because, you know, sometimes, you know, people will ask me, well, what issues did women highlight that wouldn't have been highlighted if they weren't there? And I can talk about that, although I do think it stems more from the diversity of women than the gender as per se. But what I would say about people like Katie Porter is it's not so much that they were highlighting issues or talking to witnesses that wouldn't have been before. It's just their style. Their personal style was very different. They really, it wasn't confrontational just to be confrontational and make a splash on TV, which happens so often in these hearings. They really came with receipts. They had the goods to really drill down to the issues and put people really in the hot seat. And she was sort of the master of that. And she's funny and people like that. She's also very tough and a little mercurial. and that comes out a lot when you spend time with her and watch her, and her colleagues all know that. And she's tussled with a lot of them and staff and so forth. But she is a tough, also funny, I think, very sort of what you see is what you get, authentic lawmaker.
You also have to mix and mingle, right? You have to go to those receptions at night. You have to find where your alliances are and make alliances among your body. What is that like?
That's very true. You know, Congress, like every workplace, but probably even more so, is very much about relationships. You need relationships with your colleagues to get them to co-sponsor legislation and vice versa to get things done. Sometimes, you know, you can be more successful working across the aisle on certain types of things. People end up making buddies with people that they sit in committees with because they're just kind of with them a lot. You know, it's like being in class. The person that's in your math class, you know, you just see them every day. And going out into the world is more about making relationships with different interest groups that can support you, that can give you information. You know, you really need to not be isolated in your office. You want to be out in your own district, in your own city or state, and in Washington, out just mingling and hearing what people are talking about. Not all members like to do that, but that tends to be an element of success.
Author Jennifer Steinhauer explores the historical turning point for Congress and for American women in her book, The Firsts. She chronicles early trailblazers and the women like AOC of today who we'll be talking about. You can join in, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up on Women in Congress right after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a diverse group of women who went to Congress hungry for change. It's the meaning behind the 116th Congress this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Representative Lauren Underwood of Illinois is serving her second term, the youngest black woman elected to Congress. She embraces the campaign motto of trailblazer Shirley Chisholm, unbought and unbossed. Chisholm was the first black woman elected to Congress in 1968. Representative Ayanna Pressley, the first black woman elected from Massachusetts, occupies Chisholm's old office today. Who is your shiro? Do you follow the squad, the Democratic congresswoman taking on the Washington establishment? Join in, 800-642-1234. The New York Times' Jennifer Steinhauer is with us, and her new book is called The Firsts. Let's bring in Sam now in Eau Claire. Hi, Sam.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to remark that I admire Representative Ocasio-Cortez's ability to not only reach these different coalitions and these different blocks of voters, but the manner in which it's being done. She's doing charity video game streams via Twitch. She is getting on Twitter. She is helping take to the streets with the Teamsters. There's very active engagement of these small fringe, but still interesting and active groups, showing that, you know, she's not just an empty suit. She's not just another sort of pawn in the game, but she has a personality and that she has quirks. You know, that's very admirable, I think.
Sam, thank you for the call. You know, Jennifer, AOC came with an aggressive policy agenda. How has she been received by Congress?
Well, I think his comment is very interesting because it points to a sort of a dichotomy that I like to talk about when I talk about AOC. There's certainly nobody more influential, particularly obviously in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I would argue she's the titular head of that wing of the party now that Bernie's kind of, you know, in his own way sort of exited that space. And there's no question that she has engaged new kinds of voters and new political coalitions across a broad spectrum of groups, both in her district in New York and across the nation. And I have to say, a year ago, in the before times, I went to Paris and I saw a poster of her outside on a wall there. So her reach, her political reach is vast, and she certainly has resonated greatly, especially among Democrats who are looking for a more progressive agenda. And frankly, with Republicans who turned her and some of the other members of the squad, they've kind of replaced Nancy Pelosi with them as sort of the symbol of what they like to paint as the so-called socialist, you know, antithesis, if you will, to them. So the interesting thing about her, though, is I think her power, and I think she would admit this too, and lament it at times, her power is very much in the political arena and not as much in the legislative arena. A junior member, not on some of the key committees she wanted to be in, And we were talking about building relationships before in Congress. She struggled with that in the beginning because she was very outspoken about even the need to primary some members of her own party. She came to Congress talking about that right away in the 116th Congress. In the 117th Congress, that sort of toned down somewhat. But because of her, the attention that's given to her, there's some also, frankly, some jealousy, some rivalries. But more, I think, again, because she has made such a name for herself in trying to get the party to move to the left, that's created a lot of tensions with more moderate members and other members of her class and in the Democratic caucus. And so she's less successful, I would say, as a lawmaker than she is in politics, where she's obviously extremely high profile and has had a great run.
How is AOC's relationship with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi?
I don't think it's that great. I think, you know, Nancy Pelosi is interesting because she's obviously been under a lot of pressure, and not, by the way, just from the freshmen, although they were great in numbers. And it's interesting because she was feeling the pressure from all sides in terms of, you know, a lot of the moderates who were in Republican districts don't want to be aligned with her for obvious reasons. That's not popular back home. But some of the younger, more progressive members think that, frankly, the entire Democratic leadership slate is too old, been there too long, too hidebound in their ideas. So she's been under pressure to move aside, and I think she will after this Congress. But I think she was trying to figure out ways to harness the political energy and still kind of keep a lot of these freshmen in line. And that's created a lot of tensions, and I think that ultimately that happened a lot with AOC. And I don't think, in its funny way, they're not, you know, AOC is going to vote the way she's going to vote. Nancy Pelosi will not have an extreme amount of influence over her in that regard. And I don't think that AOC can convince Nancy Pelosi that that's the direction that the party is moving. So I don't think they have a ton of use for each other, but I don't think it's super acrimonious. I just don't think that they're walking the same paths in the party and in American politics at all.
What about Pelosi to you has been interesting as you watch her navigate these different factions, if you will, within the Democratic Party, aligning them and also trying to bring in people who are like a third of her age?
Yeah, no, the Republican leaders will begrudgingly admit that they can't keep up with Nancy Pelosi in that regard. She has always been a master of really kind of lassoing what you have correctly identified as a very diverse caucus, obviously geographically, obviously politically. You have people all over the spectrum, and even more so. And those divisions are more pronounced somewhat in the way they were when the Tea Party first came on the scene, the Republican Party. You started to see these cleaves, and we know where that ended up, with obviously that morphing into Trumpism, which completely defines the current Republican Party, at least certainly as it pertains to Congress. And people have been watching to see if the progressives and moderates, and I use the term moderates kind of loosely there, a lot of them are Republican, you know, people who won Republican districts. So they are, in a sense, moderate by where they come from, but their politics do differ. But just for the purpose of this conversation, was there going to be this big cleaving between progressives and moderates, as seen through a lot of these very diverse and interesting women who've been elected in the last Congress or two? And I think that Nancy Pelosi has been able to carefully and manage the individual needs of all those lawmakers just enough to keep a fragile coalition of a shrinking majority together.
You know, and for these freshmen, these newcomers, there's also just this stark way of how Congress does business, how their chamber does business, that to me, from your book, it is just, these new freshmen are just awestruck by it. And some of the, older members of Congress kind of take them aside and like, you know, hey, just go with it a little bit. I'm just thinking about the whole shoulder bearing situation. And, just how does that work in terms of advice and mentorship for these newcomers?
I think there is a lot of quiet advice and mentorship that goes on. It's not always, you know, seen or talked about. I saw actually an interview with AOC, and we were just talking about her, about the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, and she had said she had gone for a mentoring session in the ladies' library or something. So I thought that was really interesting that she was doing that. We didn't know about that necessarily. I think that that goes on a lot, but it's also, you know, it's a complicated place, and like every workplace, where people's, less great instincts tend to come out in the workplace. That's just, the psychology of all workplaces, and that's true in Congress, too. So there are, again, those rivalries and jealousies, and I think a lot of the older members who embraced these women coming to Congress, both because they made Congress more female, and obviously among Democrats, they were excited about freshmen because there were so many of them, and that gave them the majority. But they got tired of hearing about them by the end of the 116th Congress. Now they're sophomores. Now they've got a little bit more seniority. You have the unprecedented case almost of having a lot of these freshman members, particularly women, at the end of the last Congress, becoming chairs of subcommittees, which was unheard of even in the post-Watergate era when you had a big kind of loud and politically interesting freshman class. So I think there was this pull to try to keep people within the seniority, hidebound, traditional Congress. But then there's the push, including letting women bare their shoulders in the dresses that they wear on the floor of the House and Senate, to having a class that's really large say, hey, we're freshmen or we're sophomores now, but there's a lot of us, and we need to have more say by dint of our numbers and the fact that we're this new generation of lawmakers. Not everything can be driven by seniority, and that's the push and pull that you see there.
We're talking with Jennifer Steinhauer, who is a veteran political reporter at the New York Times. Her new book is The Firsts, looking at the journey of these women in Congress. Should we be encouraging more women to run for office? What do you tell your daughter? What do you tell your granddaughter about political office? Are you concerned about the lack of women in Congress and the difficulty of women to juggle a family and serve in the highest seats of government? 800-642-1234 to join in. Jennifer, you mentioned there the squad. Can you tell us about the squad, who is in it, and how it is perceived?
Yes, I have a couple of thoughts about that. So the squad, as it's formerly known, is AOC, as we mentioned. You talked about Ayanna Pressley from Boston. Ilhan Omar, who is from Minnesota, as we all know, Somali refugee. That's her backstory. Was briefly the Minnesota legislature, ran for Congress and won also in 2018, as well as Rashida Tlaib. She had a long career in the Michigan legislature, and then she eventually got to Congress kind of from a community organizing background. And that was the original squad. But I always like to say, they kind of bonded when they got to Congress, and they were very much the face of a younger, more diverse, and more progressive wing of the party. And again, that was something that Republicans used to leverage against them. And in many ways, the reason that they became so high profile as a group is because there was a point when former President Trump kind of put them in his crosshairs, if you will, and talked about how they should go back to where they came from. And he really lumped them as a group and sort of tried to create them as the face of the Democratic enemy. And so that's how they became, their national profile rose as a group. But I always like to say, in many ways, those four women are very much products of their districts. They have their own sort of political base and way of doing things. They don't always vote in concert. While three of them supported Bernie Sanders, Ayanna Pressley originally had supported her home state senator at the time, Elizabeth Warren. So they don't always do the same things. I think the bigger squad in terms of cohesiveness is the women who call themselves the badasses. And those are women who are veterans and women who have a national security background. I'm talking about like Abigail Spanberger, who just barely won re-election from Virginia, Elaine Loria, also from Virginia, Mikey Sherrill from New Jersey, Chrissy Houlihan from Pennsylvania, and Alyssa Slotkin from Central Michigan, who's really become more high profile because of her previous roles in the Department of Defense and her close contacts there. She's really has a lot of credibility on those types of issues. These women have had a lot of impact on the Armed Services Committee and how we talk about national defense, because they were veterans and worked in that space. They all knew each other before they ran because they would do events together while they were running, and they had a group that Vote Vets, which supports Democrats who are veterans. So they came to Congress already friends. There were some men in that group too, and then the women were kind of their own subset. They're this group chat. They really work together on legislation. They tend to all vote the same. They come from similar districts where they unseated Republicans. I think in terms of practical matters in Congress, they're more of a squad, where the squad is more of a political squad, if you will, and a symbolic one.
Jennifer Steinhauer has been a New York Times reporter for more than 25 years. Her new book focuses on the 35 women who were newly elected in the 2018 midterms, remaking the face of Congress. What role do you think Congresswomen will have in the upcoming Senate trial of former President Trump? How do you think women stand out in Congress? Should more women run? Are you or someone you know considering a run? What do you think about organizations like Emily's List? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with veteran New York Times reporter Jennifer Steinhauer. She spent a year crisscrossing the Hill and in home districts, following in the footsteps of the women of the 116th Congress, the shoulder-bearing, baby-wearing, media-savvy multitaskers, and most of all, fire-in-the-belly women who are boldly taking on the Washington establishment, trying to get stuff done for their constituents back home. Still time for you on Notable Women in Congress, 800-642-1234. And author Jennifer Steinhauer is with us for 10 more minutes. Jennifer, there's this, perhaps it's a myth, or this expectation that Congress members have these long gaps in their schedule, long downtime in their home districts, and they have these weekends to just chill out. But that isn't the case. That's not what you found.
No, I mean, that's not the case. And the funny thing is, I take on board the criticism of Congress and their absolute lack of popularity, and there are very good reasons for that. It is pretty much a broken institution. You could have an entire hour just about that. But one thing that's unfair criticism of the vast majority of members of Congress is that they're lazy, and that they don't, and that they recess period when they go back to their home states and their home cities, that they're, you know, kicking it up and watching football. That's not really entirely the case. First of all, you can't get reelected if that's what you do. Your presence at home is very important. You're meeting with everything from 4-H clubs to local mayors and the governor of your state. You're doing events. You're visiting hospitals. You're visiting garbage dumps and seeing what's going on. You know, if you're going to try to get yourself represented in an infrastructure bill, you need to know what's going on, what the infrastructure needs are, what's going on with the airports and the dumps, the town dumps and everything in your district. So it's not always a glamorous stuff. And it's a pretty busy schedule, both in terms of being able to legislate effectively and also, frankly, to press the flesh with donors and with constituents and make sure that they, you know, have town hall meetings and meet with people and make sure that they perceive that you are available, accessible, and meeting their needs.
And so these freshman women you found they're commuting back and forth. They haven't moved their families to Washington.
For the most part, I mean, some people who live really far away do have their families in Washington. Others don't. Sometimes it's a little bit of a mix. It depends on how old mm-hmm. their kids are. They want their kids to be going to school in Washington. And, you know, by the way, it's been well documented that that's the way Congress used to work. Everybody moved here and lived here. And there's a lot of school of thought that that's why there was more comedy in Congress back then, because people spent more time socializing with their families and after hours and so forth. But that's just really not how it works. Now, people expect their member of Congress to be back home. And the worst thing that you can do is quote, you know, go Washington and not be around very much.
Do women govern differently?
This is the subject of a lot of academic work, actually. And there is some evidence that there are times when women will work more cohesively around specific issues. That certainly was true in the 70s when you had a very strong women's caucus, because they didn't have any gavels and they didn't even have many roles on important committees. And so they worked together to do things that they could on a bipartisan basis advocate for from that ledge. But most of the research shows now that there's not significant evidence that women necessarily govern more cooperatively, although that's the perception. It still is driven mostly by partisan politics. Although I will say that if you look at something like the Nevada legislature, which mm-hmm. is the only legislature that is majority female, it's a small and very slight majority, but it is, they tend to accelerate issues that I won't say men aren't interested in or don't pay attention to or wouldn't vote for, but they tend to circle around specific issues. Like, I'll give you a good example is, you know, requiring rape kits in police stations. They're going to pick up on that issue. It's going to be a no-brainer for them. It's going to be bipartisan, and they're going to push for that and accelerate that on an agenda. That's what you see when you have a lot of women in Congress, but it's not about their necessarily their working style. It has more to do with identifying issues that can be embraced by a majority of women, that you just need a lot of women in large numbers to have that type of legislative agenda be advanced in that manner.
Well, I want to take this home to Wisconsin here. In 2012, our own Tammy Baldwin became the first Wisconsin woman and the first openly gay politician elected to the U.S. Senate. How does Baldwin's achievements in office affect other women? What do you see out of her?
Well, it's kind of interesting. A lot of times when you have first, it feels very dramatic at the time. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later, it's like, oh, what's the big deal with that? I'm not even sure. People, when they think of Tammy Baldwin, they may associate with her with certain legislation. I think, quite frankly, I can tell you from the Washington perspective that Tammy Baldwin is considered one of the more cautious, quiet, not outspoken members. She probably has a very different perception, as is often the case with members of Congress back home, in terms of how she interacts with her constituents and others. So I think that's what people think of now when they think of Tammy Baldwin. And now you have more and more openly gay members of Congress. And I think it just becomes one of those things in American life, which is one of the beautiful things about our country and our culture, is that things that seem very groundbreaking or very unusual or even impossible very quickly revert to the status quo and unsurprising.
Talking with Jennifer Steinhauer from the New York Times, her new book is called The Firsts. Jennifer, Vice President Kamala Harris, first woman to hold the number two position. What will her influence be over Congress and the women who look up to her?
Well, right now, if things stay the way they are, her influence in Congress will be tremendous because she's a tie-breaking vote in the Senate. As you know, in a 50-50 Senate of Democrat-Republican, she will be back in the Senate probably more than she ever imagined when she first went for becoming vice president. But I think what will be really interesting, if she takes on those traditional roles that vice presidents do of traveling abroad and representing the U.S., which, you know, such a weird time right now because nobody's doing that because of the COVID crisis and pandemic internationally. But just for her, specifically a woman, but also a Black woman to be representing the U.S. on the international stage, I think it'll be very interesting to see how she is received. And the other piece of it, which is very important and comes back to the women in my book and comes back to the women in Congress, is this concept of what we call in sociology descriptive representation. Seeing someone who looks like you in these positions, that sounds kind of like a Hallmark card nice thing. It's actually very powerful. There's ample evidence that increases people who seek office when they see people who look like them and come from their social class, their race, their background to run. It's extremely influential. And I could see young women looking at these new women in Congress, and you can kind of see the wheels turning toward the concept of possibility. And I think that is one of many roles that she will play as the first female vice president.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Jennifer Steinhauer is a veteran political reporter for the New York Times, more than 25 years. Her latest book, it's called The Firsts, The Inside Story of the Women Reshaping Congress. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.